Okay, let's go to that handout, the idea of biblical theology, and work through this hour. Gerhard Hassel begins his article entitled "The Future of Biblical Theology." You'll find that on that bibliography published in 1979. With the statement, quote, "Biblical theology is today in a state of disarray. The disturbing fact that there is no one definition of this field on which biblical scholars can unanimously agree is highlighted by the diversity of approaches in the unprecedented volume of recent publications. No less than 11 different theologies of the New Testament appeared in a period of, that should be Old Testament, that's a typo, of the Old Testament appeared in the period 1967 to 1977. And at least 12 different theologies of the Old Testament were published between it's 11 New Testament theologies and 12 Old Testament theologies between 1970 and 1978. See, we're talking about biblical theology, so it covers both fields. That is New Testament. Eight more recent ones are listed in your bibliography. Since 1970 to 1990, you're talking about 20 Old Testament theologies being written. That's one a year for the next 20 years. An analysis of these theologies, the Old and New Testaments, reveals basic disparities regarding the nature, function, method, and scope of biblical theology. Deep historical, theological, philosophical, and methodological problems are underlying these divergences and call for creative reflection. Now, that's taken from Gerhard Hassel, just to give you an idea of how much activity there is in the area of biblical theology in the last 20 years. As I've mentioned, part of the purpose of this course is to introduce you to some of the problems and issues which divide scholars in the field of biblical theology, both Old Testament and New Testament, into different methodological approaches. Much of this will emerge in our reading and discussion of Hassel's book, Old Testament Theology, Basic Issues and Current Debate. For today, however, I would like to suggest the lines along which, in my own view, biblical theology and its Old Testament and New Testament divisions should be approached and developed. There are several articles that have been especially helpful for me for laying out the field of study and for providing definitions and a structure for the discipline, which seem to me to be both faithful to biblical principles and conducive to fruitful research in an area of study that is at least relatively new and in need of methodological clarification and direction. Now, the articles are, and I have three of them listed here, and four, but two under John Murray. I found these articles quite helpful. First, Voss, The Idea of Biblical Theology as a Science and as a Theological Discipline in Redemptive History and Biblical Interpretation, edited by Gaffin, pages 3 to 24. This was his inaugural address as professor of biblical theology at Princeton Seminary, given on May 1894. And as we go further, I'll make a number of references to that article because it's a kind of a seminal article as he maps out the field. Then John Murray's two articles, Systematic Theology. You might think that's all about systematic theology, but it's not. It's a lot of discussion in relation between systematic theology and biblical theology in those two articles. And then Richard Gaffin, Systematic Theology and Biblical Theology in the Westminster Journal in 1975-76. As may be deduced from the titles of these articles, one of the fundamental questions that needs to be asked, and to which quite different responses have been given, is that of the relation of biblical theology, whether in its Old Testament or New Testament form, to systematic theology. In the century subsequent to J.P. Gabler's inaugural lecture at Altdorf, March 30th, 1787, entitled, quote, "About the Correct Distinction of Biblical and Dogmatic Theology and the Right Definition of Their Goals." Now, I might mention here in parenthesis, Gabler's lecture was very influential on the development of this discipline of biblical theology. So, Hassell discusses that in the book you're reading. If you want to look into that issue a little bit further, see the article in the bibliography by J. Sandis Wunsch and L. Eldridge, as well as the discussion of Gabler and Hassell, pages 21 to 24. That article by on page 2, Sandis Wunsch, S-A-N-D-Y-S-W-N-S-C-H, two-thirds of the way down page 2 of your bibliography. J.P. Gabler and the Distinction Between Biblical and Dogmatic Theology. Translation, Commentary, and Discussion of His Originality in Scottish Journal of Theology, 1980. In the century subsequent to Gabler's lecture at Altdorf, most of the studies designated by the term biblical theology tended to be strongly influenced by rationalistic presupposition and tended to view biblical theology as a descriptive historical discipline. In other words, a discipline ruled by the historical critical method. While systematic or dogmatic theology was considered to be a normative discipline that yielded a contemporary expression of faith based on the philosophical and cultural milieu of its time and place of origin. In other words, one discipline was more confessionally oriented, systematic theology. It's what you believe and how you organize what you believe. Biblical theology was considered a historical discipline. It was more scientific. So, going back to the time of Gabler, you got that kind of a distinction made between biblical theology and systematic theology. And of course, someone like Voss or Murray or other people that we have been discussing here would not accept that formulation of the issue. Voss challenged that approach to quote, biblical theology. Let's go further. It appears to have been the recognition that biblical theology, differently and more properly defined, was a legitimate field of inquiry, along with the recognition that its study was being dominated by improper or illegitimate methodologies that led the Princeton Seminary faculty to make the following recommendations at their meeting of May 1st, 1891. Quote, "The faculty would represent to the board of directors that in their judgment it is of great importance that a professorship in biblical theology be established in this seminary. Its growing importance demands that it should be erected into a separate department and be made the exclusive work of a separate professor. Generous friends of the seminary have pledged such an addition to its funds as to make them sufficient for the support of such a professor." Comes from a note in Gaffin's article, page 284. That, of course, led to the appointment of Gerhardus Voss at Princeton Seminary. With the appointment of Gerhardus Voss as professor of biblical theology, this request was granted. In his inaugural lecture, Voss described his own conception of the nature and method of biblical theology in a manner which, in my view, remains unsurpassed. As Gaffin points out, quote, "Within the Reformed tradition, Voss has no predecessors for his conception of biblical theology. In this respect, his work can be called creative and injects a fresh impulse into Reformed theology." End of quote. Both Gaffin and John Murray adopt the definitions and methodology proposed by Voss as their own. Voss begins his address by noting that, quote, theology, in its most basic definition, is knowledge concerning God. In sciences other than theology, Voss notes that it is man who takes the first step in subjecting the object of study to his scrutiny. In theology, however, it is God who takes the first step to disclose himself to man in a way that he may receive true, although never complete, knowledge of God. Strictly speaking, then, says Voss, we should say that not God in and for himself, but God so far as he has revealed himself is the object of theology. That's in his article, Idea, page 5. He then defines biblical theology as that part of exegetical theology that deals with the process of the self-revelation of God deposited in the Bible. That's his definition of biblical theology. It deals with the process of the self-revelation of God deposited in the Bible. He says that in his Biblical Theology, page 5, in his article on Idea, page 6. He says biblical theology is part of exegetical theology. He sees theology as a whole divided into exegetical, historical, dogmatic, and practical. Four areas. And biblical theology is a subdivision of exegetical theology, in the way he views it. And it deals with the process of the self-revelation of God deposited in the Bible. Quote from Idea, page 7, the next paragraph. The specific character of biblical theology lies in this, that it discusses both the form and contents of revelation from the point of view of the revealing activity of God himself. In biblical theology, both the form and contents of revelation are considered as parts and products of a divine work. In systematic theology, these same contents of revelation appear, but not under the aspect of the stages of a divine work. Rather, as the material for a human work of classifying and systematizing according to logical principles. Biblical theology applies no other method of grouping and arranging these contents than is given in the divine economy of revelation itself. End of quote. Thus, as Murray points out, biblical theology deals with the data of special revelation from the standpoint of its history. Systematic theology deals with the same in its totality as a finished product. The method of systematic theology is logical. That of biblical theology is historical. Or, as Voss states it later in his address, biblical theology, rightly defined, is nothing else than the exhibition of the organic progress of supernatural revelation in its historic continuity and multiformity. End of quote. I think that's a key statement. I'm going to use that statement to structure the rest of our discussion here. Voss speaks of biblical theology as the exhibition of the organic progress of supernatural revelation, its historic continuity and multiformity. The three terms that need to be stressed or underlined in this statement to grasp Voss' conception are progress, continuity, and multiformity. And I think with those three concepts, you really get an idea of the way in which he approaches biblical theology. Progress, continuity, multiformity. Let's look at each briefly. First, progress. Voss stresses historical progress as a characteristic feature of supernatural revelation. God's self-revelation is, quote, a work covering ages, proceeding in a sequence of revealing words and acts, appearing in a long perspective of time. The truth comes in the form of a growing truth, not a truth at rest. Or as Murray puts it, quote, "It cannot be denied that special revelation had a history. God did not reveal himself to man in one great and all-embracive disclosure. Since we are mainly concerned with the revelation that postdates the fall of man, and also to a great extent with redemptive revelation, it is apparent that this revelation began with the Proto-Evangelium to our first parents, was expanded," that's Genesis 3:15, "was expanded more and more through successive generations and ages, and accumulated progressively until it reached its climax in the coming accomplishments of the Son of God in the fullness of time, the consummation of the ages. Our perspective is not biblical if we do not reckon with this history and with the process and progression which it involves. And our study of special revelation would not only be too restrictive, but it would also be dishonoring to God if it did not follow the lines of the plan which he himself pursued in giving us this revelation." End of quote. Because of this stress on the process and progress of special revelation, as it has been preserved in the writings of the Bible, both Voss and Murray prefer the designation "history of special revelation" for the discipline under consideration, rather than the more popular but less precise designation, biblical theology. See, what Voss does is really treat a history of special revelation, and that's in the title of this book, term biblical theology, but it's a history of special revelation, which is more precise designation of the discipline. Yeah.
Another word, another phrase for redemptive discipline.
No, because see, you get it there. We'll get on into issues that relate to that. You get into the question, the relation between revelation and redemption. Redemption, somebody's worked out in history. Revelation is really a commentary on what God was doing historically in bringing to pass his works of redemption. We'll get back into that.
Was the Proto-Evangelium a redemptive promise?
Yes. Yeah, I see what you're saying. He speaks of redemptive revelation. He says, "We are mainly concerned with the revelation that postdates the fall of man, to a great extent with redemptive revelation." See, there certainly is revelation that's pre-redemptive, but with the themes creation, fall, redemption, that redemption theme really begins Genesis 3:15. All right. Voss suggests that by imparting elements of the knowledge of himself in a divinely arranged sequence, God is showing how we might gradually be brought to the true knowledge of God, but much more significant than merely the limitations of the human subject with respect to this characteristic of special revelation is its ground in the nature of revelation itself. And here we're getting close to the issue you bring up. Let me quote Voss at this point from his article Idea. Quote, "Revelation is not an isolated act of God, existing without connection with all other divine acts of supernatural character. It constitutes a part of that great process of the new creation through which the present universe, as an organic whole, shall be redeemed from the consequences of sin and restored to its ideal state, which it had originally in the intention of God. Now, this new creation, in the objective universal sense, is not something completed by a single act all at once, but it is a history with its own law of organic development. It could not be otherwise, inasmuch at every point it proceeds on the basis of and in contact with the natural development of this world and of the human race, And the latter, i.e. redemption, new creation, being in the form of history, the former, that is revelation, must necessarily assume that form likewise. It is simply owing to our habit of unduly separating revelation from this comprehensive background to the total redeeming work of God that we fail to appreciate its historic progressive nature. We conceive of it as a series of communications of abstract truth forming a body by itself and are at a loss to see why this truth should be parceled out to men little by little and not given in its completeness at once. As soon as we realize the revelation is at almost every point interwoven with and conditioned by the redeeming activity of God in its wider sense, and together with the latter, connected with the natural development of the present world, its historic character becomes perfectly intelligible and ceases to cause surprise. End of quote. Those of you who have read Voss's Biblical Theology perhaps recall his discussion of this same matter in his chapter, The Nature and Method of Biblical Theology, where he points out that revelation is the interpretation of redemption. It must, therefore, unfold itself in installments as redemption does. See, that's a key issue. Revelation is the interpretation of redemption. And since redemption moves along historically over a long period of time, revelation moves along with that progress of redemption. While this is then an important characteristic of revelation and indicative of its linkage with God's work of redemption, Voss makes some further distinctions which are of vital importance for understanding both the nature and significance of God's redemptive activity and the relationship between revelation and redemption. While positing the linkage of revelation and redemption, as we've just noted, Voss notes that it is also, quote, obvious that the two processes are not entirely coextensive. For revelation comes to a close at a point where redemption continues. The reason for this, according to Voss, is to be found in connection with an important distinction that is to be recognized within the sphere of redemption itself. Voss coins two terms in an attempt to make this distinction clear when he says that redemption is partly objective and central and partly subjective and individual. By the first term, objective and central, he refers to those redeeming acts of God which, quote, take place on behalf of, but outside the human person. By the second term, subjective and individual, he refers to those redeeming acts of God which enter into the human subject. Voss explains that he uses the term central with the objective works of redemption because they are acts outside the human person which occur in the center of the circle of redemption. That is, they concern all alike and have no need of, nor are they capable of repetition. He applies this term to such divine acts as the incarnation, atonement, resurrection of Christ. The acts of redemption in the subjective sphere he designates as individual because they are repeated separately in each redeemed individual. This term is then applicable to such divine acts as regeneration, justification, conversion, sanctification, glorification. This distinction within the field of God's redeeming acts is then of significance with respect to understanding the nature of God's work of revelation because, as Voss puts it, quote, revelation accompanies the process of objective central redemption only. And this explains why redemption extends further than revelation. To insist upon its accompanying subject of individual redemption would imply that it dealt with questions of private personal concern instead of with the common concerns of the world of redemption collectively. Voss hastens to add, Voss hastens to add, however, that this does not mean that the believer cannot, for his subjective experience, receive enlightenment from the source of revelation in the Bible, for we must remember that continually, alongside the objective process, there was going on the work of subjective application, and that much of this is reflected in the Scriptures. Subjective individual redemption did not first begin when objective central redemption ceased. It existed alongside of it from the beginning. The progress of revelation then has its primary ground in the nature of revelation and its relation to the process of redemption. Voss says that it, quote, "It is as unreasonable to expect revelations after the close of the apostolic age as it would be to think that the great saving facts of that period can be indefinitely increased and repeated." End of quote. In his biblical theology, he suggests that there is only one epoch in the future when we may expect objective central redemption to be resumed, namely at the second coming of Christ, when great redemptive acts concerning the world and the people of God collectively will take place that will add to the volume of truth we now possess. The progress of revelation is also to be connected with one other aspect of its nature. Because revelation is closely connected with the history of redemption, it is inevitably progressive. But in addition to this, it must also be noticed that in a number of instances, revelation becomes identified with history. Or to use Voss's term, it becomes incarnate in history. Besides using words, God also employed acts to reveal great principles of truth. What Voss has in mind here is not just prophetic visions or miracles, but the great outstanding acts of redemption, such as the deliverance of the Israelites out of Egypt and the crucifixion and resurrection of Christ. In such instances, history itself is revelatory. There is in such acts themselves, as Voss says, a self-disclosure of God. This means that act revelation must be considered in addition to word revelation. But again, this very thing implies and requires progress. As Voss says, these revealing acts necessarily assume historical relations among themselves and succeed one another according to a well-defined principle of historical sequence. And he adds, "Furthermore, we observe that this system of revelation acts is not interpolated into the larger system of biblical history after a fanciful and mechanical fashion. The relation between the two systems is vital and organic. These miraculous interferences of God, to which we ascribe a revealing character, furnish the great joints and ligaments by which the whole framework of sacred history is held together and its entire structure determined. God's saving deeds mark the critical ethics of history and as such have continued to shape its course for centuries after their occurrence." End of quote. It should be noted, however, that this emphasis on revelation through act or event is qualified by Voss in a twofold manner. I think that's important when you talk about revelation through deed or act, revelation incarnated in history, you know, apart from word revelation. Qualifies in two ways. One, when revelation and the redemptive acts of God coincide, the primary purpose of such acts is not revelation, even though this is important and essential aspect of their purpose. Paul says, primarily, they possess a purpose that transcends revelation, having a Godward reference. Purpose in reference to God to satisfy divine justice. So it would not be proper to view these acts exclusively or even primarily under their function with respect to revelation. Yet Voss holds that the revealing element in such acts is essential. The two ends of satisfaction and revelation being combined into one. Second way in which Voss qualifies his emphasis on revelation through act or event is to point out that such act revelations are never left entirely to speak for themselves. He emphasizes that the revealing acts of God never appear separated from his verbal communications of truth. Word and act always accompany each other, usually with the act preceded and followed by word revelation. Voss comments, quote, "To apply the Kantian phraseology to a higher subject, without God's acts, the words would be empty. Without his words, the axe would be blind. I think that's a key statement on this issue. Without God's axe, the words would be empty. In other words, the acts tend to confirm an already spoken word. But without his words, the acts would be blind. If you simply had historical events and no interpretive word, the meaning of those events would be obscured. That's what he's saying. Be the mystery in history. Now you look at history today, how do you interpret what's going on? What's going on in the Middle East today, historically? How do you interpret that? We don't have a prophet here like Isaiah or Jeremiah to give us a divine word on that. So, you know, you can read that a lot of different ways. And there's obscurity and mystery there. And so what he's saying is history is really mysterious without the word, the interpretation. But the other side is, without God's acts, the words would be empty. But without his words, the acts would be blind. The revelation in history approached Old Testament theology. That's one of the approaches. As, for example, represented in the book of D. Ernest Wright, God Who Acts. A good illustration of that. Very interesting book to read, by the way. But the revelation in history approach Old Testament theology, as represented by G. Ernest Wright, did not sufficiently take into account the role of word revelation, which is indispensable for divine revelation in history to be perceptible with any degree of certainty and clarity. See, G. Ernest Wright wanted to limit divine revelatory activity to his work in history and eliminate the idea of word revelation. I don't think he successfully really see what he would then say about Israel's theological ideas. These were inferences that Israelites made from their history, from their own historical experience, without word revelation. To return to Voss's definition of biblical theology as the exhibition of the organic progress of supernatural revelation, its historic continuity and multiformity. Let's look at the term continuity. We talk about progress. Now, continuity. Notice that Voss not only speaks of continuity, but also of the organic progress of revelation. The stress on the organic nature of progression in revelation is important. In order for the idea of progress and development not to at the same time suggest imperfection in the earlier stages. As Voss says, the truth of revelation, if it is to retain its divine and absolute character at all, must be perfect from the beginning. But when biblical theology, quote, also undertakes to show how the truth has been gradually set forth in greater fullness and clearness, these two facts can be reconciled in no other way than by assuming that the advance in revelation resembles the organic process through which, out of the perfect germ, the perfect plant and flower and fruit are successfully produced. The growth of revelation is thus viewed as an internal expansion, an organic unfolding from within. Voss illustrates this characteristic of revelation by saying, the gospel of paradise is such a germ in which the gospel of Paul is potentially present. The gospel of Abraham, of Moses, of David, of Isaiah, and Jeremiah are all expansions of this original message of salvation, each pointing forward to the next stage of growth, bringing the gospel idea one step nearer to its full realization. End of quote. It is in this connection that Voss introduces the covenant idea as the structuring principle of divine revelation in the Bible. He says, in this gospel of paradise, we already discern the essential features of a covenant relation, though the formal notion of a covenant is not attached to it. And in the covenant promises given to Abraham, these very features reappear, assume greater distinctness, and are seen to grow together, to crystallize, as it were, into the formal covenant. From this time onward, the expansive character of the covenantal idea shows itself. The covenant of Abraham contains the promise of the Sinaitic covenant, The latter, again, from its very nature, gives rise to prophecy. Prophecy guards the covenant of Sinai from assuming a fixed, unalterable form. The prophetic word being a creative word, under the influence of which the spiritual, universal germs of the covenant are quickened and a new higher order of things is organically developed from the Mosaic theocracy. That new covenant of which Jeremiah spoke, and which our Savior brought to light by the shedding of His blood. So dispensation grows out of dispensation, and the newest is but the fully expanded flower of the oldest. End of quote. In this statement, Boss presents the covenants as the structuring principle of continuity in the growth of revelation and redemption. The last sentence of this statement is perhaps a good illustration, well, it's next to the last sentence, of a comment about Voss by J.F. Janssen in the Princeton Seminary Bulletin when he complained about the literary style characteristic of Voss' writings. His writing is exceedingly ponderous. Paragraphs run on for pages. One does not always find a clear indication of direction or clear summary of findings. He tends to write in paragraphs rather than sentences, and it connects thoughts with thoughts with thoughts. But nevertheless, I think the idea is clear. John Murray follows Voss in concluding that the covenantal idea is the structuring principle of biblical revelation. Murray says, "The covenantal institution is basic to any construction of redemptive history and revelation. The Exodus cannot be biblically interpreted unless it is recognized to be in fulfillment of the patriarchal covenant. Sinaitic covenant must be understood as an appendage to an extension of the Abrahamic. And the coming of Christ is in pursuance of the same. Christ is the seed in whom all the families of the earth are blessed. It should be apparent how indispensable to biblical theology is the covenant concept, and how far removed from the biblical data our theology must be if it is not oriented to the successive unfoldings of covenant grace and relationship." End of quote. In concluding his discussion of this feature of divine revelation, Voss says, "Because the New Testament times brought the final realization of the divine counsel of redemption as to its objective and central fact, therefore New Testament revelation brought the full-grown Word of God, in which the newborn world, which is complete in Christ, mirrors itself. In this final stage of revelation, the deepest depths of eternity are opened up to the eye of the apostle and seer. Hence the frequent reoccurrence of the expression before the foundation of the world. We feel at every point that the last veil is drawn aside and that we stand face to face with the disclosure of the great mystery which was hidden in the divine purpose through the ages. All salvation, all truth in regard to man has its foundation in the triune God Himself. It is this triune God who here reveals Himself as the everlasting reality from whom all truth proceeds, whom all truth reflects, be it the little streamlet of paradise or the broad river of the New Testament, losing itself again in the ocean of eternity. After this, nothing higher can come. All the separate lines along which, through the ages, revelation was carried have converged and met at a single point. The seed of the woman and the angel Jehovah are become one in the incarnate Word. And as Christ is glorified once for all, so from the crowning glory and perfection of His revelation in the New Testament, nothing can be taken away, nor can anything be added thereunto." This brings us to the third term by which Voss characterizes the role of biblical theology in its treatment of special revelation as contained in the Bible. Remember, he defines biblical theology as the exhibiting of the organic progress of supernatural revelation in its historic continuity and multiformity. Now, we've talked about progress and continuity so far. So, the last section is on multiformity. I'm just looking, how far do we have? We have another 5 pages. Are there any comments or questions at this point? I'm just wondering whether we should go ahead or whether wait for this number 3 till next week. Yeah.
Revelation as defined in the Word as the Scripture and redemption. Then again, you move on to make it one more. think he keeps the distinction. He says revelation is the interpretation of redemption.
But what about the acts of redemption? Since they are under revelation.
All right, at that point. At a certain point, at certain points, revelation becomes, to use his terms, incarnate in history, so that the event itself is revelatory. Although he says that's not its primary purpose. Its primary purpose is Godward, but it carries with it a revelatory aspect, manual. But when such revelation is incarnate in history, it must also be accompanied by word revelation to be intelligible. So yes, at a certain point there could be a convergence of revelation with these great objective central acts of redemption. Yes, that's true. But let me just add to that. The task of biblical theology is to work with the history of God's special revelation, which is word revelation, as contained in the Old Testament.
How would you define
the
direct revelation in the Old Testament? And then before, what after the confirmation, or God actually doing something miraculous? Those, I would understand the direct revelation.
All right.
Without any interpretation,
necessarily it's really down to you. Yeah, it may depend on what specific event you're thinking of. You take the say the pillar of cloud by day and the fire by night, to lead Israel through the wilderness. Certainly that was a direct revelation, indicated to Israel when to move and when not to move. But you see, that didn't just appear without a word revelation. You know, Moses was told this is going to happen, and then it happens. And so when it happens, they understood what it was. It wasn't as if just all of a sudden a fire appeared, you know, or a cloud appeared. Had that happened without word revelation, what would you make of it? Yeah, I'm not so. I don't know. I don't have a, you know, in this bibliography, and I'm not aware, maybe somebody else is aware of a biblical theology Old Testament written by a dispensationalist. Offhand, I don't think of one. Now, there have been some, I guess J. Barton Payne's theology of the Old Testament, J. Barton Payne would be labeled a, quote, dispensationalist by some people. Yet, J. Barton Payne would, the only part of his book, he quotes from Boss. He would, I'm certain, accept Boss's definition here of biblical theology of the Old Testament. Although, again, J. Barton Payne, his theology, does not structure his Old Testament theology on the basis so much of historical progression as he does on themes or concepts. So he'll treat the Old Testament as considered, in that sense, it's kind of a systematic theology of the Old Testament, because he'll take the Old Testament doctrine of sin, the Old Testament doctrine of redemption or whatever, and give a more a systematic treatment of that from within the Old Testament context than what Boss is suggesting, to let the flow of divine disclosure itself and historical progression be what structures the theology. And don't bring other outside structures to it, but simply a historical progression to it. But I don't know, someone else here help me with that on how would a dispensationalist define Old Testament theology differently than Gerhard is Lewis?
Well, I think it's
I'm not sure I can answer that.
In the our definition should be was the organic progress.
Yeah.
Someone as revelation was pursuing the historical continuity. So that's the earlier we.
You mean, is that definition debatable?
Yes.
I think it's a good definition.
Yes, according to the cardinal idea.
Yeah.
According to the dispensation, in its historic continuity, that phrase
historic continuity
does support the organic progress of supernatural revelation.
I'm not so sure dispensationalists would even dispute that. The point, in other words, dispensationalism might order the Old Testament according to dispensations. And I can't list you what the names of all them are, but of human government, of conscience, of law, whatever. There would certainly still see a progression and continuity, a movement from the one to the next to the next. So I'm not so sure at that point there would be that much difference. I think the point of difference, both continuity and discontinuity, would come more in the question of the relationship between the Testaments, and more particularly in the relationship between Israel and the Church, where instead of seeing a strong measure of continuity between Israel and the Church, there would be seen a sharp discontinuity between Israel and the Church. But I say sharp discontinuity, that depends, particularly today, on who you're talking about. Because today, that sharp discontinuity is a lot less pronounced than it was 10, 15 years ago among people who give themselves a label dispensation. They are beginning to admit that there are elements of continuity between Israel and the Church. But they'll stress more the discontinuity. So it really becomes more a question of where you put the stress. Of any absolute continuity of discontinuity. So as far as continuity, I think between dispensationalists and covenant theologians wouldn't be so much the question of progress and sequence and development and continuity, say, within the Old Testament period. It's more between Israel and the Church where you get the point of disagreement and discussion. Any other questions?
Didn't you all say that this progress could be organized around the country?
Boss, I don't. Murray says that.
Oh, Murray.
Murray says
that.
Yeah.
And again, that would be another major.
They would use the dispensations as their organizing team rather than the covenants. And again, there's a certain amount of overlap there.
This is just an additional question. Last summer, the Faith Center building was on sale.
Was it?
Yeah. Did you know about that?
Stephen gave us an auction.
Oh, there was an auction then?
Yeah, they had an already auction. So one of the faculty members is a Korean professor, Dr. Sam Jung Lee. Now he's teaching an extension of Dallas Theology Center. So he was a strong cabinet professor, right?
Yeah.
But now with
that's interesting.
I don't know. So what made him so sure he's not to be able to teach here?
I don't know. I can't respond to that. I'd just say this. He was teaching a faith. He was probably a premillennialist. And I think in the minds of certain people, covenant theology is equated with amillennialism. So if you are adherent to covenant theology, in the minds of some people, you must be an amillennialist with respect to your millennial position, or you have eschatology. I don't think that's a necessary conclusion at all. I think you can hold to covenant theology and be an amillennialist, a premillennialist, or postmillennialist. I don't see any necessary connection between your millennial view and your view of the covenants. On the other hand, it's often, I think, the perception of dispensationalists, if you are an adherent of covenant theology, that you will be an amillennialist. And you see it just from the other side, the same issue. I don't think that necessarily holds. I don't know this man, but he probably was a premillennialist. And being a premillennialist may have been sufficiently satisfactory to PCB to consider him full dispensational. The terms are very misleading and confusing because it's very hard to define what a dispensationalist is. I think to use the term as a label is almost meaningless. So then when you're talking about a particular person, you have to pretty much start talking about views of various questions or issues. There was an article some years ago in Journal of the Evangelical Theological Society by Ken Barker, who used to be head of the Old Testament Department of Dallas, and then was general editor of the NIV Study Bible. He was dean at Capital Bible Seminary in Washington. I think now it's left there, I'm not sure what he's doing. In that article, he writes from a dispensationalist background. He calls himself a dispensationalist, but he speaks about seeing certain continuities between the Testaments, between Israel and the church, that he feels dispensationalists generally have not paid sufficient attention to. Now, if you read that article, it's about 10 years ago. I don't know what your own conclusion would be, but when I read that article, I felt very comfortable with the position that he developed and the conclusions that he drew. I would, if I was going to give myself a label, say I was an adherent of covenant theology. I would not call myself a dispensationalist. Yet, in substance, I don't think what he was saying was much different than what I would say on the same issue, yet he would call himself a dispensationalist. He probably would not want to call himself a covenant theologian. But you see, you're dealing there with labels, not with substance. And I think at certain points, you have to get behind the labels and see where people are in certain issues. And I think often the labels tend to divide and obscure more than help in a lot of these discussions. I guess there are times that you said there was an auction at Faith Seminary, or you're building?
The building, they were close to the center, and the building was auctioned.
So they don't own the building anymore?
No, that's still,
it's still on the
building. There was never, I saw the newspaper, never went out.
But did they sell contents into the building?
It's not on, it's still true. Oh,
okay, sort of another issue, but one of some interest since I've taught there for a while and lived there for a while. So. Or the side mansion. Okay, I'll see you next week. We'll pick up with this last section.